Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 6 years ago, California drew a line in the sand in the spirit of allyship, banning state-funded travel to states with anti-LGBTQ plus laws. And in the time since, what began with a handful of states has grown to nearly half of the country, which is having some California Democrats reevaluate the effectiveness of the travel ban, and one in particular wanting to reverse course altogether. State Senate President Pro Tempore Tony Adkins authored a bill to repeal the state-funded travel ban. The Democrat, who is the first lesbian to lead the state Senate and Assembly, joined Insight earlier this year to argue the better solution is to increase outreach to states with anti-LGBTQ plus laws, with the goal of building bridges, raise awareness, and break down discrimination.
I grew up in one of those states. I know what it's like to feel isolated. I know what it's like to feel like you have no support around you. And I think the ability to be there and to be present speaks volumes, because it really is personal relationships, direct communication and contact that change hearts and minds. I know that. It changed my parents.
Now we're getting a better idea of how California's state-funded travel ban affected both Californians and the states targeted. CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon joins us with that piece of the debate. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
So take us back to 2016. Remind us why this law, which boycotted state-funded travel, came about.
Well, it kind of started with North Carolina. They passed a law in 2016 which required people to use public bathrooms that correspond with their sex assigned at birth. This was seen as a very targeted attack on transgender people. There was a lot of fallout, particularly in North Carolina, after they passed that law and the governor at the time signed it. There were entertainers, pulling out of their concerts. The NBA moved their All-Star game. I think an NCAA tournament also got canceled or moved. And California also passed this travel ban, saying that it would prohibit state-sponsored travel to any state that authorizes or requires discrimination against people because of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. And this ban initially included North Carolina, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Kansas. And then just to be clear off the top here, it does not ban California residents or state employees from going to those places. It just bans, the state won't pay for that travel.
Yeah, it's not on the state's dime.
Right. We've got freedom of movement still.
Exactly. When it comes to, so what started with four states, as you just laid out, now we're in 2023. Where does the list of state-funded travel bans, where does it stand now?
Well, as of last month, it's 26 states now. It's more than half the country, so I won't list all these states, but it's grown every single year that this law took effect in January 2017. So sometimes I think one year there was one state added, one year as many as five or six, particularly as laws banning transgender girls from playing high school sports or banning gender-affirming care for trans teens has, you know, as these laws have passed in these red states over the past couple of years, this list has just grown and grown.
Mm. And as you mentioned, Californians can travel wherever they want. But when it comes to state-funded travel, give us some examples of what it's used for.
Yeah, you know, conferences is a huge one. These annual professional development meetings for, a number of state employees. I think doctors who work at state or university hospitals, state lawyers, accountants, professors, state lawmakers even, though they have a way around that. They use their campaign funds to go to these conferences sometimes. Sports travel has also been a big thing with this travel ban. If a state university is playing road games against a university in a place on this travel ban, that team needs to find private funding. Utah and Arizona are in the Pac-12, but they're also on this travel ban list. So if, say, UCLA or Cal Berkeley has a game in Utah at the University of Utah, they've got to raise that money for that travel. And then another thing is research. I think we can get into, I talked to a researcher who ran into some roadblocks trying to go to North Carolina to do some research on LGBTQ plus issues.
Mm, so this has a lot of consequences that, we might not think of off the top of our head. That brings us to the new bill from Senate Pro Tem Tony Adkins, that this bill would essentially repeal the law. What would this new bill accomplish?
So it would repeal this travel ban, but it would replace it with a marketing campaign to encourage inclusivity in those states. And this would be funded through private donations. I think this is still, you know, in its early phase, obviously hasn't been created yet. So it's not totally clear what this would look like. But Senator Atkins has talked a lot about, you know, sending message, a positive message, kind of that pivot from isolation to inclusive messaging to other states, you know, in support of the communities impacted there.
And we touched upon that argument that the Senate pro tem made when they joined Insight earlier this year. Is there evidence or data out there to really show the impact that state-funded travel bans are having, for better or for worse?
You know, there's actually not a lot of research or data on these kinds of travel bans, or California's ban in particular. Senator Atkins' office couldn't point me to any thorough research on this topic. A lot of this is anecdotal. And I will say, though, that the state of California is not the only one considering this shift. San Francisco also had a ban on travel and contracting with states that's similar, but it was much more expansive. The list was 30 states and it included contracts. And the city found in a study that it actually drove up their contracting costs by like 10 to 20% because they had such limited options with their law. So there is a measurable economic cost there. Less measurable with California, but there is, you know, a lot of anecdotes out there.
Yeah. And you spoke with people directly impacted. You know, let's start with academia. How did this law impact research at California public universities?
Yeah, I mentioned the researcher that I spoke to, Mark Stein, is a history professor at San Francisco State University. He had booked a research trip to North Carolina before the travel ban took effect in January 2017. When he got back from that trip, he submitted his request for reimbursement. That was denied because this ban was now in effect. He ended up getting reimbursed because he had booked the travel before. He also later found a workaround, which is that his research position is funded through a university-affiliated corporation, not the university itself. But, you know, in talking to him, he's acknowledged that that's a bit different. And there are many, many researchers and student researchers out there who don't have access to funds like that. So, you know, we've also heard reports of this kind of happening for people researching the impacts of abortion and abortion laws, that they can't go to these states or they can't go to states to present their research. Mark Stein has told me that this ban likely impacts what topics students research. He gave me two examples about if a student is choosing a dissertation topic, a PhD student, and they're thinking about like the Tulsa race riots or the anti-gay Johns committees that Florida instituted, you know, several decades ago. They're not able to go to those places to go do archival research. So they could fundraise and go through a lot of hoops to go do this research, or they could pick a topic in California and have no problem getting a funding approved to go to LA or somewhere to do that research.
Yes. So financially, it's just more of an uphill climb.
Yeah. So that can lead to undercovered topics in those states. And it further leads to this isolation that Senator Atkins has talked a lot about.
Mm. OK, so when it comes to the existing law and the new bill that would essentially repeal the boycott, what is the professor's view on this?
Well, he doesn't support it. He says that
he doesn't support the new bill.
He does not support. And he said he talked with Senator Atkins' office about this, actually. But, you know, he says he supports something a little more middle of the road. He doesn't think that this law has had enough time to have an impact. You know, he talks about how conferences are scheduled years in advance. So maybe it just hasn't had enough time to have the economic impact, the economic impact that lawmakers intended. He also just thinks it's not the right moment to send this message.
There's obviously a large political debate going on in this country about where we want to head on abortion rights, on LGBTQ rights, on teaching about race in our public schools. And it's really, I think, a bad idea to send a symbolic message at this moment that progressive states are going to abandon these policies, you know, based on, I think, unproven arguments that they've not been effective.
So I mentioned that he, you know, instead he'd support an exemption to this travel ban for social justice research, or, you know, like the kind of study he does on LGBTQ history, or just a broader higher education exemption.
Yeah, so it's more nuanced for him.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to the states that have been directly impacted, I mean, this law began with North Carolina. Did you get a sense of how this state has been impacted with really several years of a boycott?
Yeah, well, I talked with Whit Tuttle, who's the director of North Carolina's Tourism Bureau, and he said that tourism economies are just very broad and diverse, so it's very hard to measure impacts from things like this.
Most people don't, you know, say, hey, I was going to come and I was going to spend $5,000, but I didn't. Some people tell us that, but most people don't. And like I said, the real gap is you don't know what you could have gotten. You know, it's one thing if an organization is looking to host a convention here and they tell us, hey, we're not hosting it here because of this travel ban. It's another thing for them to not even consider us in the first place. And then we don't know that we could have even hosted them at all.
So he says, you know, that it's very possible and probably very likely that North Carolina just stopped being considered for big, you know, conventions and conferences. And so they don't, they're not able to measure what they could have gotten. Another couple things on this, you know, the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic obviously had a huge impact on tourism economies across the state. So again, like, a major event where it's hard to measure impacts. And again, you know, the professor Mark Stein mentioned that it can take several years for boycotts and travel bans to have a noticeable impact. So the tourism director in North Carolina did say that this has had a negative impact. It's just very difficult to measure the exact economic cost here.
And where do those laws stand in North Carolina? Haven't they changed since then?
Right. The bill or the law that started all of this was repealed almost 3 years ago. And there is a process for North Carolina to be removed from this travel ban list, but it's still on there, even though this law hasn't been in effect for almost 3 years. It's the one law that's cited. So it's not like there's some other anti-LGBTQ plus law that's keeping North Carolina on there. There's one law, and it's this law that no longer exists. Wow.
Is this bill that Senate Pro Tem Atkins authored, is it gaining traction among lawmakers even across the aisle?
Well, it's passed its origin in the state senates and the assembly now. It got overwhelming support from Atkins' Democratic colleagues in the Senate, less support from Republicans. I did talk to the author of the original travel ban legislation, Assemblymember Evan Lowe, earlier this summer about this. He wasn't committed to supporting Atkins' repeal proposal. He said he had some questions about whether this is the right move. You know, he pointed out that the travel ban is also a way to protect public employees of California who may be LGBTQ from having to go to other states where they may be targeted or have certain rights or accommodations taken away. So, he sounded like he might be looking for some answers and maybe some amendments, which we'll see when lawmakers get back from their recess later this month and take bills up again.
Finally, Nicole, I mean, California is known for taking bold ideological stances, you know, from reproduction rights to immigration to LGBTQ plus rights. And you've joined us multiple times, you know, explaining all of these issues and moves that the state is making. Is this raising a larger conversation about finding the right effective response to stand for what the state believes in while minimizing unintended consequences?
You know, one thing elected Democrats in California love to do is stake a position on social issues and be sort of that marker for the left for the rest of the country. I'm thinking about also Governor Gavin Newsom went after his own party last year for not being more aggressive on protecting abortion rights after Roe v. Wade was overturned. But lawmakers can also stake these positions through legislation. And I think as other states clamp down on abortion and LGBTQ plus rights and these other social issues, Democratic lawmakers here, you know, they feel like they have a responsibility to reach out and help those impacted communities, even if they're not in California. One argument that Tony Atkins has made for repealing this travel ban is that the state set aside money to help people come here to get abortions if they need it or they can't get one in their home state. Well, if they're from Texas, Arizona, Oklahoma, or any of these other 23 states on this travel ban, the state wouldn't be able to buy that person a plane ticket home. So it is kind of creeping into and complicating their fight on other, you know, progressive issues.
Nicole, thank you.
Thank you.
Nicole Nixon is CAP Radio's politics reporter discussing a bill that would repeal a state law that bans state-funded travel to states with anti-LGBTQ plus laws. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. There's a corner of the world where a growing humanitarian crisis is unfolding and getting worse every day, with very little of the world's attention. 120,000 Armenians are at risk of dying of malnutrition, medical emergencies, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. While the focus of world leaders continues to be on the war in Ukraine, Azerbaijan has quietly blockaded and cut off food, energy, and medical resources to Armenians living in their ancestral homeland called Artsakh, a small area sandwiched between modern-day Armenia and neighboring Azerbaijan. Armenians living in the diaspora, especially here in California, which is home to the largest population of Armenians living outside of their native country, have been calling for the world's attention. But getting the world to intervene and help prevent this crisis has been met with mostly generic calls for so-called Azerbaijani aggression to stop. Eric Hagopian is a California political consultant who has worked on numerous campaigns and knows the state capital well. He also knows very intimately the political and humanitarian situation unfolding in Armenia, as he's been living in the country for the better part of the last 6 years. And he's an analyst for an independent Armenian media outlet called Civil Net. Eric joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Very nice. Great to be with you today.
Thank you for taking the time. We're going to get into the why in just a moment, but can you explain to listeners what is happening to the 120,000 Armenians and specifically where we are talking about?
There is a section, it's a region between Armenia and the neighboring country of Azerbaijan called technically Nagorno-Karabakh. The Armenians call it Artsakh. During the Soviet period, there was this tendency to essentially create problems by putting sections of one group of ethnicities in another one. So you have this divide and conquer type scenario. And this is exactly what you have. Technically, that area, which is Nagorno-Karabakh, is considered legally to be part of Azerbaijan. But it has essentially a complete Armenian population in the 100th percentile. But at this point, what you have is you have a situation in which there's an attempt to essentially ethnically cleanse these people out of their region by cutting off the only road that they have to the rest of the world, which is a road through this area called Lachin Corridor. And it's been blocked by this regime in Azerbaijan, which is led by one of the most, vicious dictators in the world, Ilham Aliyev, who is actually the corruption's man of the year at some point a couple of years ago. So your typical oil state dictator. And the object is to essentially starve people out of their ancestral homeland. And for more than 200 days now, access to food, medicine, transportation, essentially anything that goes into normal livelihood has been cut off, including gas and electricity, which they've been cut off for most of that period. But local resources in a small area can only go so far. So we're reaching the point where You're seeing malnutrition, you're seeing pregnancies fail, you're seeing people pass out. We're not that far from a Bosnia type situation, unfortunately.
The area that you're describing, I mean, when you look at a map, it's essentially a breakaway territory, correct? And it's essentially surrounded by Azerbaijan with that Lachin corridor, which was really their only access point.
Absolutely. It's an enclave. It's an enclave, and it's surrounded by this regime whose intention is to essentially drive peace, to make life so miserable that people leave on their own. While there's actual violence that breaks out and where they shoot at people, they kidnap people. In fact, a couple of days ago, there was the International Red Cross, which is the only organization that works in the area, was transporting patients to Armenia for surgeries. And they actually kidnapped one of the patients. Which is to show impunity, and because they want to shove the International Red Cross out of the region, because they're the last international organization that works in Karabakh, in Artsakh. So I think that that tells you, if you have a regime that's willing to kidnap people that are being transported by the International Red Cross, that's on the same level as ISIS or Al-Qaeda, to be honest.
Yeah, and this blockade started in December. You mentioned it's been going on for more than half of a year already, and it just continues to get more dire. Can you explain the political dynamic that's happening in Armenia? What is the response by the Armenian government?
Well, I mean, this is all complicated by the fact that there's very intensive negotiations that are led by the United States and the West to have a comprehensive peace settlement. I think the United States actually is acting in goodwill here in trying to essentially create a scenario in which people can live there with their rights and their securities. This blockade is actually a backhanded attempt to essentially do away with this negotiations, because the other side really does not want peace, because it doesn't serve regime interests. When you have a dictatorial regime that has nothing to offer her people, what they have to offer is ethnic hatred and war. And a peace agreement does not serve the interests of the regime. So if you're in the middle of negotiations and suddenly you go off and do this, what you're telling the world is, I'm going to do everything possible to blow up the possibilities of having a long-term established peace, because long-term established peace, as we have seen in the case of Russia and Ukraine, does not serve the interests of totalitarian states that have very little to offer their people.
And all of this is unfolding as, you know, California has a large Armenian population, the largest in the world. When you talk to people who are part of this diaspora, I mean, what is the sentiment to this blockade and this humanitarian crisis in their homeland?
I think, to be honest, it's hurt in the sense that you're not part of the approved victim group. So... Armenians sort of fall in the middle. They're, you know, in some ways we're too white for the left and too dark for the right, you know. So it's you don't fall into the attention that it should get. This is the second biggest humanitarian crisis in Europe at this point. Is not there. All the focus on Ukraine, as it should be. I mean, I'm not downgrading what's going on there. This is essentially a Putin ally doing this in another corner of Europe, and the rest of the world is far more tolerant of this particular dictator than they are of his patron in Moscow, which is Vladimir Putin. So it's the double standards that are, are hurtful more than anything, to be honest.
Well, let's get to the international response. I mean, not too long ago, 2 years ago, President Biden officially recognized the Armenian genocide, which happened more than a century ago. It began in 1915, and that was a huge moment for Armenians because prior presidents had not officially recognized that as genocide. When it comes to lawmakers in our country, I mean, especially those who represent large Armenian constituents, there are statements, you know, calling for sanctions against Azerbaijan. But has the U.S. really announced tangible action to help save lives, given how dire of a situation it is right now?
No. Because is complicated. You would need to ask them, but no, they have not. And I think part of the reason is that, you know, the argument is it's much better to have a comprehensive peace treaty that settles all issues, except people can die now. So in a comprehensive peace treaty, doesn't really change anything. I think this is, there's this myopia of, you know, who you're dealing with. When you're dealing with a regime that clearly states its intentions as genocidal, you have to take their words seriously. One of the things that I've learned, you know, I've worked in California Democratic politics, and I say that in small d Democratic politics. Politicians say all sorts of things, but I've learned that totalitarian leaders are far more honest. You know, they will tell you what they want to do. They will tell you that we want to kill you, and then they'll proceed to killing you. Democratic politicians, you know, will dance around in words, and there's this tendency not to accept the reality of who these people are and what they're trying to do. And when a person constantly talks about it's my way or the highway, or if you don't like it, you should leave. And when you're negotiating with someone and you suddenly cut off 30,000 children from food, medicine, and shelter and heat, what do you take that as? What do you take that as anything but, in a lack of a better phrase, fascist aggression?
Does the reluctance to step in by the international community, does it extend to other allies of Armenia, like France?
France in particular is probably the most proactive country in Europe, because France itself, I think there's very strong cultural bonds between the two countries, and a huge Armenian diaspora in France, probably the biggest one in the world, the biggest one in Europe. They're far more aggressive, but overall, European policy is made by the European Union, who are, you know, to say, to be kind, bland bureaucrats without any great moral vision. You know, everything is something that can be, you can't, it's very hard to cross a red line with them. So, you know, they will, everything can be worked out. Everything, they will not, there's no strong moves and clarity in denouncing what is unacceptable. And we saw what the consequences was last year when Russia invaded Ukraine. If you reward aggression, if you reward talk of ethnic cleansing, if you reward people who have ill will, they will act accordingly, because the language they understand is the language of force and the language of there'll be consequences for your actions. If there are no consequences for your actions, why would any dictator act differently? And this is exactly what we're dealing with in this case between Azerbaijan and Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh in this case.
Yeah, there's a complicated web of relationships as well as consequences, especially when talking about international relations. You touched upon Russia has some ties in this. Armenia and Russia do have some ties. What is Russia doing, if anything, to try and keep the peace or to facilitate humanitarian aid?
Nothing. Russian supposed peacekeepers are in the region, but given the fact that their country is in alliance with the regime in Azerbaijan, they're essentially facilitating this and essentially using it to overthrow. This is an attempt to overthrow the current Armenian government that is quite democratic, pro-Western, and pro-American. So this is a way, this is a joint project to punish the Armenian nation for its democratic turn in 2018, and specifically its Western turn over the last 2-3 years. Hmm. So this is, in some ways, this is actually the second front in the Ukraine war between the West and the East, except the West doesn't understand that the people that it's dealing with are actually our enemies or don't want to admit it.
Hmm. You're painting a understandable dire picture, and I know you don't have a crystal ball, but how do you see this ending for the 120,000 Armenians that are in this breakaway territory, essentially in limbo with really a dire situation that's continuing to deteriorate with the blockade going on now more than 6 months? How do you see it ending?
Actually it's 8 months now. You know, when they I've learned one thing is you know that they always say in these Holocaust memorials, genocide memorials, they always say never again. It's a lie. There always is never again if the victim is of the right sort. So we could be actually looking at that. at the current time. It could be that, you know, 6 months from now, everyone, you have, you know, Srebrenica 2.0 in Europe, or you could have complete ethnic cleansing. It is entirely within the cards. So it really comes down to, are your standards universal? Is your talk of never again, never another Holocaust, never another genocide, is it true or is it just talk? Because this is the point, that there's no more moral ambiguity here. When a regime is trying to starve 120,000 people that it does not like, because it is not because of their ethnicity and religion, which is the simplest form of racism, by the way, and the simplest explanation of racism, the hatred of someone based on their ethnicity and religion. Is the world willing to act? And in this case, the world's powers. And, you know, legally, from a legal perspective, both international law and U.S. law and the different European countries, if there's a threat of genocide, you actually have to act. It's not even a question. That's one of the reasons in 1994 that the United States was sort of reluctant to call the Rwanda genocide until after the fact, because if they had, then the Clinton administration would have to have take action. So this is really what it comes down to. There is no context in which starving 120,000 people is acceptable. So if you think it's acceptable by not acting, then what you're really saying is that never again is actually not true.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with California political analyst Eric Hagopian about the mounting humanitarian crisis affecting Armenians who are surrounded and blockaded by Azerbaijan. Eric has lived in Armenia for the last several years. Given that you've been in politics for quite a long time here in California, what led to moving to Armenia in 2017?
Well, it's really a funny story because I'm 56 now, and I turned 50, and I go, you know what, after 30 years of doing campaigns, I wanted to do something different, have some kind of teach someplace in a university or something and have some comfortable life. And the exact opposite happened. Not only none of my clients left me, because this sort of happened during COVID where no one was meeting anyone anyway. So now I spend nights working with my California clients and my mornings doing my broadcast and these other activities that I'm involved with. So I'm actually working more than I ever did, even in California. And if you know campaign schedules, you're working 18-hour days. So it's one of those ironies of you want to change in your life, but circumstances take you to another direction. And this is where we're at.
Yeah. I mean, you're a commentator in Armenia for the media organization you mentioned called CivilNet, which calls itself an independent online media and TV platform focused on strengthening democratic and economic development. Your show is actually called Insights, which is similar to the title of our show. What led you down that path and wanting to get involved in this and being an independent voice in Armenia?
Well, because frankly, you leave the media landscape in the areas within the post-Soviet space is actually very poor. And independent media is rather limited, as it is, frankly, in the United States in some level. But you're dealing with the quality of journalism is rather low. And I'm not a journalist, but when you have analysis that is not overly politicized and partisan, it's somewhat unique. And to have someone that has actually U.S. political experience is something that you don't really see regionally in there. And especially my show is in English, but it gets translated into Armenian and Russian. And actually our biggest audience is Russian, which is actually quite interesting. It had more to do with a filling a vacuum than it's something that I really wanted to do, because I started doing commentary on television and the sort of like, you should have your own show. And then it just became something much bigger than I ever expected.
When it comes to freedom of the press issues around the globe, the organization Reporters Without Borders, you know, they kind of rank accessibility to independent media. Armenia ranks 49th out of 180 countries. For context, the United States is 45th out of 180 countries. So it's not that big of a difference. You know, when it comes to striving to remain independent, how do you see the future of independent journalism in Armenia or the former Soviet states, for that matter?
Actually, this is not to gloat. It's actually a sad fact. Armenia is like an island of freedom in a sea of tyranny. If actually, if you would do a map, I mean, I can get on my television show and I can criticize the prime minister, the military, the intelligence services, and no one's going to come knock on my door the next day saying, why did you say that? And I do that routinely. And if unfortunately, if you look at the map of that part of the world, you would literally need to travel from Armenia halfway across the world to South Korea to have another country that has that kind of a media environment. That's in some ways it's credit to Armenia, but in some other ways it's a sad fact of the world where you have limited freedom of press in so few parts of the world. So it's a unique opportunity, and actually, you know, some of my audience is actually from the totalitarian states around Armenia who actually, even if they don't agree with me, they get on to see like what free journalism looks like, that you can get on and you can attack this person and be critical of this person, and the guy comes back the next week and still does his show. That's not necessarily what happens in other places.
Yeah. Finally, just broadening our scope, because this transcends a lot of countries, from Russia and Ukraine, even here in the United States for that matter. How do you advise someone to ensure that they're getting accurate information instead of propaganda?
It's very difficult, to be honest, because nowadays with social media, the disinformation travels so much faster than the truth. It's just, I mean, that's always been the case. It's just amplified with social media and the kind of just sometimes utterly ridiculous nonsense. I mean, some of it is laughable, but then at the end of the day, it isn't laughable. I think what I tell everyone is question everyone, question me. You know, people should question you, not because you're dishonest. It's just, you're not going to be right all the time. And do not take on every given issue, that if it's an important one, you know, look for two or three takes on it. Look at every media source critically, not, you know, not in a conspiratorial sense, but understand that there's no such thing as unbiased media. Everyone has an angle. And it's, which is fine. You know, this notion where you're entirely, we're not AI, you know, we have our opinions and we have our attitudes. So, I think it's to be critical. You have to be an informed, news reader, in the sense that you need to, question everything. You need to have multiple sources, have it be verified, and be critical of everyone. You should be critical of me and you, but you should also be critical of the idiots that put things on Facebook without any proof.
Eric, thank you so much for the conversation and the time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Eric Hagopian is a California political analyst who has been living in Armenia for the last several years, discussing the humanitarian crisis unfolding for Armenians who are surrounded and blockaded by Azerbaijan. If you'd like to follow Eric's commentary or learn how to help raise awareness about the situation in Armenia, we have a link on our Insight page. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. From saving water to creating a worm bin, attracting pollinators, and landscaping, there is a lot that goes into creating a healthy garden. If you have a proud green thumb or just, you know, want to dip your toe in or your thumb in, Sacramento is hosting an all-day extravaganza this weekend. Harvest Day is taking place this Saturday, August 5th, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center. and it is packed with events for gardeners or enthusiasts of all levels. Joining us with more is Jane DeLeon and Peter Horton. They are master gardeners for Sacramento County. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Peter, I want to start with you. When did you get bit by the gardening bug and make it a big part of your life?
Well, actually, I've been working in gardens since I was about 5 or 6 because I come from a very large family of 11 children. At that point, it was just chores. But when I was in high school, I was kind of the family gardener, and I really got really intrigued by the fact that you could put a seed or a seedling in the ground, and you got this really cool stuff that came out. So I'm still excited about that.
And that's wonderful. How about you, Jane?
My parents immigrated from the Philippines, and they always kept a kitchen garden to assure the high quality of the vegetables they prepared for our meals, but also because in the 1950s, Asian vegetables were not readily available. So my parents grew what were then considered exotic vegetables like snow peas, bitter melon, Asian greens, and my favorite, Asian eggplant.
Mm, yes. Yeah, I've grown that actually in my backyard. Yeah, a little too much, but we had a lot of it. We find lots of recipes. Peter, what goes into becoming a master gardener?
Well, I think first you have to have a love of gardening, but I think more important than that, you want to have somebody who wants to help other people with their gardening. If you could meet those two basic criteria, then there is an application process. You are certified. So you apply, you have an interview. If you're accepted, you have about 5 months of training, weekly classes of 4 to 6 hours. And then after that, if you successfully pass the training, you can be certified as a master gardener. And then I'm going to have to quote this because I can never remember it. You're going to help the mission, which is to extend research-based knowledge and information on home horticulture, pest management, and sustainable landscape practices to the residents of California. Mm. Which is, in fact, what we definitely try to do.
Both of you are master gardeners. Peter, how many master gardeners do you think are in Sacramento?
Well, we just did a count. Remember, this is a county-based program. So we have 220 in Sacramento County, and that's part of over 6,000, actually, statewide.
Hmm. So, Jane, the both of you are married. What is gardening at? Obviously, you're being a good steward of gardening, you know, throughout California. But what does it add to, like, your life personally, even your marriage?
To my life, I would say it is still a miracle to me to plant a seed in the ground, watch it germinate, become healthy and productive. That's still a miracle. It's a very meditative process to be a gardener, I think. And for me, it makes me feel like I am a small part of something much larger in the universe. For our marriage, that's kind of a personal question, but I think I can share with you that we planted our first garden 3 weeks before we were married over 52 years ago. We have gardened ever since. We raised four wonderful sons. We've continued to raise delicious vegetables, sweet fruits to share with family and friends. Mm.
What are the issues that are currently happening in our landscapes and our gardens for people, you know, who don't have the as much experience as the both of you, but, you know, want to improve?
Sure. We frequently, as master gardeners, receive questions about many issues, but the four that rise to my mind all concern regenerative practices for gardeners and for landscapers. The first one, of course, would have to do with the precious and prudent use of water. The second has to do with responding to extremes in our weather, as we've been experiencing, and to climate change. Third would be to cultivate habitats that support healthier numbers in the declining numbers currently of pollinators, which are so helpful to productivity and health of our plants. And then finally, I would say the reduction of organic waste through composting.
That brings me to Harvest Day, because that's why the both of you are here. Peter, for someone who's just learning about Harvest Day and they're like, oh, what's going on this weekend? What is it all about? It's a full day of events.
Well, I mean, I think basically if you want to take it at the lowest level, it would just be a great place to go to just kind of wander around in a beautiful spot and look at stuff. And, you know, but it, primarily it's for people to go and learn about gardening. There's going to be a number of presentations on a variety of topics. There's going to be a lot of educational tables there from both public agencies and private gardening clubs. I think the university is going to have University of California is going to have a couple. And then you can go to the Horticulture Center and go through the various areas, the demonstration areas, and there'll be a master gardener there that can answer all your questions. Well, at least try to answer all your questions, or at least tell you where you can go to get your questions answered sometimes. And if you get hungry, there's going to be some food vendors there, so you can sit down and relax a little bit, too.
On the website, it says Harvest Day 2023 is going to be bigger than ever. What can people expect this year, Peter?
Well, I think there are going to be more of the educational tables, that there's going to be a lot more people you're going to be able to talk to about on different topics. I don't know. Beyond that, I don't know, Jane, what is it?
I would say the 30 educational tables.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. That's the most, I think. But also the Master Gardeners have been preparing for Harvest Day now for, I would say, the last 10 months. So to fulfill our mission of educating the public, we really do our best to set up demonstration tables, to have available Master Gardeners as resources. Plus, it is a beautiful place to be.
Yeah. Gardening can be intimidating for some people, and maybe some people get discouraged because, you know, they don't do it right the first time. Jane, what advice do you have for someone who's interested, but they just don't know where to start? They feel overwhelmed.
Well, I would say, first of all, the fact that someone would be interested in gardening, that's the prerequisite. I would also say that someone who wants to garden and is just starting off should have a sense of where she or he wants to be with that garden. What results? Do you want to eat rhubarb? Do you want to eat asparagus? Do you want to have vegetables, roses? What is it you want to end up with as a gardener? And then after sketching out a kind of vision, that vision needs to be supported by education and training. So I would then say the best thing to do is to try and find the resources that are available to support a person's growing interest in learning about gardening. And I would say come to the UC Master Gardeners of Sacramento County website, where we have an abundance of very clearly written, easily accessible, searchable topics that are university research-based and which can help answer any and all questions. Plus, the Master Gardeners of Sacramento County have a help desk Monday through Thursdays, mornings and afternoons. All of that information, dates, phone numbers, those are all posted on our website.
And I'd also like to say you're going to make mistakes. That's just part of the drill. And you learn from your mistakes. But I make mistakes all the time. I've been doing it quite a long time. So
yeah. When my husband and I started our first garden in Sacramento, it was during the pandemic. And so we went a little crazy with all of those seeds. And then by the end of it, we were pretty successful. We gave a lot away. We don't like wasting food. But then you realize, did we really love eggplant that much?
Oh, come on.
We love eggplant, but I mean, it was kind of, but then there were some where we didn't have enough. And then, sure. You know, for example, tomatoes, for example.
Right.
So it's good to, out of practice, to troubleshoot and see, you know, what kind of garden you really want. And obviously, it doesn't have to just be, you know, vegetables and fruit. So in terms of Saturday, Jane, what are the logistics? What should people know before going to Harvest Day?
Oh, well, we welcome families, so children are happily welcome to be there. Only service dogs, please, because we have edibles around. Admission is free, although we gladly accept donations as well. But yes, come out, bring a hat, bring your bottles of water, because it gets quite warm on Harvest Day.
Peter, finally, what are you looking forward to most this weekend for Harvest Day? It's been 10 months in the making, a lot of work.
Oh, I just like talking to the people that come. Yes. I mean, I, you know, they have questions for you and you do the best you can, but it's just interesting to meet all these people. And sometimes you actually learn more from them than they're learning from you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Jane and Peter, thank you so much for the time.
Oh, thank you for inviting us.
And the beautiful bouquet that you brought.
Yes, that's lettuce leaf basil and Sally Holmes roses and walking on sunshine roses from our garden.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us.
Oh, thank you for making the time. Jane DeLeon and Peter Horton are master gardeners for Sacramento County, and they are talking to us about Harvest Day. It is happening this Saturday, August 5th, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center, and it is free of charge. And that is Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.